This track was co-championed by Pascal Hitzler, Matthew West, and Christoph Jankowicz. And Matthew is going to be making the presentation today. Matthew, this is Tim Finan. I'll control the slides here in the room, so please remember to tell me when to advance to the next slide, and also let me know what the numbers are just to make sure we don't get out of sync. So let me turn the floor over to Matthew West, who will give the presentation on Track C, Overcoming Ontology Engineering Bottlenecks.
Hi, this is Matthew West. Good morning to you, and good afternoon to anyone who, like me, is in Europe. We had an interesting time looking at ontology engineering bottlenecks, and as you will see, we found ourselves in the middle of an eclectic mix of different issues and problems. There were three of us as co-champions here, myself, Pascal Hitzler, and Christoph Janowicz. And between us, we put together two sessions and a number of email discussions throughout the summit. Slide two. So the mission and scope for Track C was to identify bottlenecks that hinder the large-scale development and usage of ontologies and identify ways to overcome them. Slide three. The kinds of bottlenecks we were thinking we might find were ontology engineering processes that are time-consuming, social, cultural, and motivation issues, modeling axioms or knowledge representation language fragments that cause difficulties in terms of an increase in reasoning complexity or reducing the reusability of ontologies, and the identification of areas and applications that would most directly benefit from ontologies but have not yet been considered their use and development. Slide four, potential solutions, tools and techniques, research findings and methods, guidelines, documentation and best practice, automation of various sorts, the combination of inductive and deductive methods, development of a set of reusable patterns, the identification of purpose-driven modeling granularities, and lessons learned from ontologies that are seeing wide adoption, and the development of tutorials and other educational materials. Slide five. So the first session, and we had three excellent speakers. Professor Werner Kuhn, who spoke on abstracting behavior in ontology engineering. Professor Aldo Gangemi, who spoke on knowledge patterns as one means to overcome ontology design bottlenecks. And Carl Hammer, reasoning performance indicators for ontology design patterns. Slide six. So the focus for session one was modeling axioms and knowledge representation language fragments, and the kinds of solutions we were looking at were the development of a set of reusable patterns and the identification of purpose-driven modeling granularities. Slide seven. And then there were some questions that we wanted to address. How do we arrive at reusable patterns? How many patterns are there? Are there types of patterns? Are all patterns domain independent? Can we mine patterns from data? Who will develop and maintain patterns? Are there measures or at least experience reports on the robustness and usefulness of patterns? Are there success stories? How to abstract from individual ontology designs? How do we need higher level ontology modeling languages? Also, do we need higher level ontology modeling languages? How to get community buy-in, and how important is the selection of specific language constructs for scalability and reuse? So a wide range of things there. Slide eight. Some important findings that we took from the talks were that a standardized and accepted knowledge representation language, such as OWL, doesn't necessarily replace the need for a knowledge modeling language. Behavioral abstraction, so duck typing, may be one approach to support the development of more robust ontologies. Entity-centric, frame-oriented data science is required to ensure relevance of semantic web technologies and ontologies. The need for improved data-driven techniques to scale the development of patterns and ontologies without losing reference frames. And finally, the usage of specific knowledge representation language constructs has direct complex consequences for reasoning complexity, tool support, and reusability. So those were some key things we took from the talks. As you know, there's chat around all the presentations as well, and there was quite a lot going on there. And so some of the reactions were, for instance, that, well, there are an unlimited number of patterns. You can't say, you know, that we've got all of them at any point. We can mine patterns from data. That's certainly true. True patterns will mostly be discovered rather than invented. They're out there. We need to find them. When you abstract patterns from ontology designs, you're usually moving up the subtype-supertype hierarchy rather than moving out class instance. So you should not normally need another language. Buy-in comes from utility plus ease of availability and use. It's first of all important that the language constructs can support the requirements of the application. Otherwise, all is lost. So that's really against very restrictive languages like DL Logics, but they may be what you want for doing the specific reasoning on a subset of some of the data that you're looking at, but they aren't going to be helpful if they stop you holding the totality of the data that you need. Slide 10. Some important findings from the summit list discussion. We put out a separate set of questions on the ontology summit list after the first session to try to pick up on some of the things that we haven't got from the talks, and you can see the questions involved and the answers in plain. What is it that takes a lot of time and effort? Education team buy-in, and two tasks are the extraction of knowledge from the subject matter experts and the explanation of the model to developers using it. What is it that is very expensive? Refining the ontology during development to satisfy logical consistency, and the extraction of the knowledge is expensive. What is it that is held up because of lack of scarce resources? Well, we need new and better ways to discover, express, and process ontologies. Why is it that ontological approaches are not taken when they should be? Well, there's a time constraint on the delivery of ontological artifacts, means that the model and its implementation are often not separated, and current ontological approaches are too primitive. It's quite interesting because in data modeling there is much more of a separation between conceptual design, logical design, and physical design, and that's often those are steps that are skipped with developing ontologies. On slide 11, we had our second session where we had Oscar Corcho, who gave a very interesting 10 basic rules to overcome ontology engineering deadlocks in collaborative ontology engineering tasks. Darvill Thacker, who spoke about modeling cultural variations in interpersonal communication for augmenting user-generated content. And Peter House, who spoke on developing semantic applications with the information workbench aspects of ontology engineering. Interestingly, the first of these was about some of the kind of practical issues when you're developing an ontology, and the second two were about automating some of the processes. So going back to some of the things that we were expecting to see. Some key problem areas that were found in looking through these things were that ontologies are perceived as costly. There's confusion over the level of expressiveness needed. Who's going to develop the shared ontologies? How do we do quality control? What level of semantics is needed? What tools to use? and how to reuse them successfully? And why are ontologies in English, especially if you're Spanish? So going through those individually, slide 13. So ontologies are perceived as costly, and I think the key word here is perceived. Ontologies may be hard to develop, but when you look at the cost of an ontology, which is always developed as part of some larger project, ontologies are not an end in themselves. When you look at what it is as a proportion of the overall project at a business improvement level that they are part of, they're generally a relatively small proportion of the total cost. I can give you a personal anecdote on that. I used to work for Shell, and we developed a model of Shell's downstream business. There was a question about whether we should actually do this or not. And so I was asked to produce an estimate, which was, I don't know, something like $2 million or something like that. And the guy looked at his budget, who was leading the project overall, looked at his budget, which was several billion dollars, and said, look, that doesn't even register on the error in my budget. Just do it for heaven's sake. And that's not an untypical situation, really, once you actually look at it. Timely and appropriate ontology development will reduce overall project costs, whereas no implicit ontology or late development of ontologies will lead to higher overall project costs. The key thing, and the key, couple of words here, timely is a key word. The level of benefit that you're going to get from doing an ontology at the wrong place in a project's life cycle means that you will get significantly less benefit from it. At the right time, it will just stop you making mistakes. And the challenge there is actually demonstrating that you've delivered a benefit, because all that actually happens is that mistakes didn't happen that would otherwise have happened in the process of developing the project. And it's quite hard to point to those things. But you may well be able to point to the disasters that happened in a previous project where there wasn't an ontology as part of the as one of the deliverables. And so the key thing is really being able to make that case that this is actually what you're going to you will be delivering by including ontologies as part of the deliverables. Slide 14. Just a moment. Oh, I killed that phone. Slide 14. There's confusion over the level of expressiveness that's needed. Different applications will require different levels of expressiveness. Expressiveness is important for descriptive ontologies where the queries are not known at design time. When you do know the queries to be answered, it is often possible to construct a more restrictive ontology that will answer those queries with improved performance. You may need multiple ontologies or a master and subset to meet all needs in a domain. So this is going back to that idea that if you on the one hand you need something very expressive so that you can capture the totality of what's out there, but actually to deliver answers, it's more likely that you're going to need to work on a subset of the data. And selecting that subset and processing it efficiently is then likely to be a good way to go. Slide 15. Who's going to develop the shared ontologies? Firstly, of course, many ontologies will be private. So, your company accounts are going to be private. On the other hand, product catalogues, although they are private in the sense that they are owned and created by one person, they're made available to the public. And then you have public administration data and standards, most of which one would hope would be public. It's being paid for by the public. It should be available to the public. And the next key thing is that what you are looking for is the authoritative source to develop those ontologies. One of the things that's a bit of an issue at the moment, for instance, is just how many different places you can find a unit of measure ontology. And really what you want to do is have it there is one place, and it's the people who are the authoritative source for that data who would actually be the ones that create it so that everyone else can reuse it. And this avoiding replication, which, and if you have replication, you need to have reconciliation as well. But I think that we're away from people being aware of a sense of obligation to deliver that. So, for example, governments should develop ontologies related to their laws. Standards bodies should develop ontologies that relate to the standards they have. Now, one of the things to be careful about here is that an authoritative source does not have to be an authority. Okay, there's a difference. So, it's been put here as non-authoritative, but alternatively, a multitude of individual ontologies can be integrated via ontology alignment. So if you have, for example, a person with a mobile phone and a GPS unit in it is the authoritative source of where they are. They're not an authority, but they are an authoritative source. And you can combine data of that sort from different authoritative sources to provide useful data. But the key thing is knowing whether it's authoritative or not. Is it first hand? Or is it second, third, fourth, or fifth hand? That's part of what you want to know, and therein provenance is a key thing. Slide 16. How do we do quality control? Well, the first answer we got was test, test, test. And there was some objection to that as well, because you really want to minimize the amount of testing that you have to do. And you should, with modern software development techniques, be able to do a lot more on quality assurance before you get to the testing point. Nonetheless, you do in the end need to test. It's just the same as with software development quality control, data quality control. Ontology is not fundamentally different from these, and it's not hard to find literature that tells you about how to do those things. And quality control is a reasonably standard thing that you can pick up. It's a tool you can pick up and use. Inferencing tools can help with logical consistency to look specifically at things going on in ontologies and how logic can help. But there are many more errors that can be made beyond logical consistency in ontologies. So slide 17, what level of semantics is needed? Okay, well, the key thing is identity, which means the same name for the same thing used throughout. Or as one of my friends and colleagues used to say, the list of famous names. They're names that you use because they're the names that everyone else uses for something. This has a high priority because without that, you have almost nothing. Having to map everything to everything else, it just makes a huge, just a huge sink to suck resources into. And indeed, it's out of this that master data management and such disciplines have arisen. The level of semantics required varies from application to application and domain to domain. So some examples that were quoted were that in engineering, quite a lot of semantics is needed. In the geosciences, also quite a lot. In the life sciences, it's a medium amount. And say in publishing, it's very little as they focus on vocabularies. So there are different levels of reasoning that you may need. So finally, slide 8. What tools should we be using? It's sensible to start with lightweight tools like Excel when you're developing an ontology. And the main reason for this is that they're tools that are going to be familiar with your users, So we're talking about capturing requirements in the first place, and a tool like Excel is very very easy to fix to do the things that you want to do in a short way. But ultimately, you can't manage large complex ontologies through lightweight tools. You need tools that understand the structure of ontologies and do the job right. The key thing is judging the time that you move over from lightweight tools to the heavyweight tools. And it's somewhere in the analysis process between requirements capture and ontology documentation. Slide 19. How do you reuse successfully? Well, there are two kinds of things. Sometimes you're in a position where you're wanting to reuse something, and you're trying to find something to reuse before you build something yourself. So one of the things to remember is that reuse is not an objective in itself, generally. The main purpose of reuse is to reduce the cost of development. There may be times when actually having something common and shared is an objective, but it also the ontology also has to do the job, not just be used by lots of people. Determining requirements for reviewing candidate ontologies to reuse, and reuse is successful when it reduces costs and increases quality. So then if you find that you are developing something and you're hoping that it's something that will be reusable by others, the first thing to remember is that reuse is unlikely to be achieved unless it is a design objective. If it's not a design objective, then and sometimes even if it is, then what tends to happen is that you take the shortcuts necessary to deliver what you need now, because that's where the cost pressures are. Never mind the benefits down the line. This is one of the problems with a project-based approach to delivery, is that you are nearly always pressured by the costs of the project rather than the lifetime cost of whatever it is you're developing. Common errors are that the ontology is over-constrained, range and domain are set at too low a level of abstraction, and the highest level in a particular domain rather than across domains. Local domain constraints may sometimes be more suitable. Okay, slide 20. Why are ontologies in English? This is really about the identifiers. Many ontologies intended for reuse are designed in English, and it's assumed all users will use English. This just isn't valid. It's pragmatic that ID should be in the language of the developer, since this helps the development and debugging process. And so if the developer is English, it's not surprising if the IDs are English labels. But you shouldn't expect that. And at the very least, ID should be hidden from end users, who should be able to choose the language for the labels they see. So that means that you need to have an internal ID system and an external labeling system that can be multilingual if you're expecting it to be used in a multilingual way. Slide 21. So, some reflections. You will have seen bottlenecks and various uses of ontologies in big data and the semantic web are many and various. It was really hard to detect any kind of pattern in the different sorts of issues that were coming up. As I said at the outset, it seems to be just a really eclectic bunch of stuff, and who knows how much we've missed in this quick survey that we've done here. Where there was a bit of pattern was in where the solutions lie, and that there were a significant range of solutions that were about applying automation to tedious tasks, and the development, reuse of ontologies and ontology patterns was also a clear way of overcoming development bottlenecks. Each of those areas have their own issues, never mind that they provide some relief to the overall pattern. Okay, well, that's what I had to say, and what we achieved in Track C. Are there any questions?
Well, let me say thank you very much, Matthew, for your presentation. And we do have up to 15 minutes for discussion and questions. So if you have a question here on the floor, perhaps you could turn your mic on or raise your hand, and I'll try to bring this mic around and ask Matthew. Oh, please identify yourself first for the people who aren't here.
Hi, this is Beth DeJulian. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton, and I'm particularly interested on slide 19. You talked about range and domain being set at too low of a level of extraction. I'm grappling with this now, looking at reference standards and trying to decide what should be my range and domain. Can you talk give us some examples of where you have found this to be an issue?
Yes, I think it's a very simple example is for example, in whole part, what can be a whole and what can be a part. And if you were, for example, developing a spare parts catalog, you might think that the range and domain should be equipment type and equipment component. But actually, of course, that's not a pattern that's restricted to types of equipment. You can actually anything whole part by type. In fact, anything that can be applied to pretty much. That's where the problem usually comes from. It usually comes from something being developed within a particular domain, and then people from another domain looking to reuse it. And unless you recognize when you are developing the ontology in that domain that, well, actually, there's a much more abstract pattern here, and I'm really inheriting that down to this level and maybe specializing it a bit, unless you recognize that's what you're doing. This is what I mean, that this is part of the design for reuse thing. If you didn't have the idea of reuse as a primary purpose, then you probably wouldn't think that I need to place these patterns at the right level and think about where the right level is.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, another question?
Todd Schneider. Matthew, there are several questions on slide 10 that were put on the chat room. If you'd scroll back up there.
Slide 10. My slide 10.
Correct, your slide 10.
Yes, that's right.
So the first one had to do with the term model on slide 10. You used it in, it appears, two different contexts. And I wonder if you could clarify that.
Can you... I'm just trying to find it. Which question?
I'm sorry, I don't have my timestamps turned on. Well, on slide...
Oh, sorry, I'm looking at my slide 10 on the PDF slide that was on the screen. Is that the right thing I should be looking at?
The first and last.
Oh, okay, the explanation...
We're looking for slide 10.
Okay.
Oh.
Model equals ontology. And there was somewhere else where?
The bottom.
Right. So time constraint on the delivery of the ontological artifacts means that the model and its implementation are generally not separated. And again here, model means ontology.
So the ontology is different than its implementation?
Yeah, as in not the model, as in model theory model. So what it means, what the second one is saying, is that instead of, and that's what I try to explain, the way that that's done in data modeling. In data modeling, you would actually develop a number of levels of data models. So you'd have a conceptual data model, which is actually fairly close to an ontology, as an abstract ontology. You would have a logical data model, which has all the attributes in a fully normalized form. And then you have a physical data model, which is the logical data model denormalized to support the particular queries in the most efficient way. And effectively, and what people were reporting was that people were skipping over those first, in ontology development, they were seeing people skip over those first two and go straight into developing an ontology directly as the one that you're going to process over, rather than having gone through those design stages before. You'll recall that we went through this, I think it was last year even, in the Ontology Summit last year. We went through the different way, the development life cycle.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. How about way in the back with the remote mic? You had a question?
This is Rishi from NIST. So the question I have is, should we look ontologies more like architectural perspective containing multiple modules? For example, classification is one module, axioms as one module, instances as one module, and try to come up with architectural patterns so that the ontologies are more reusable. For instance, we can develop an ontology classification as one module, and then back to develop axioms itself. So these two components are independent, and multiple communities can define their own axioms based upon the same classification. That way, it is more reusable architecturally.
Well, this is again for me, I think it's just some of this is about how you talk about things rather than what's really going on. If I think about, for example, what I expect an upper ontology to have, then I expect it to have those core things that everyone uses, like classification, like subtype, supertype, like whole part. And I expect particular domains to take and use those, and in some cases specialize them and introduce the additional constraints that they have in their own area, the additional rules and constraints that they have. And I think that kind of layered approach is what's needed. You want classification to just be what classification is, and you want mereology to be what mereology is. There are some variations in that, of course. But you want to keep those different theories well-defined and separate, and again, you want them to be reused. And more complex theories are going to combine and reuse those perhaps in different ways and extend them. And those are things that you need to allow. Now, what precisely is a module? I mean, I would think that an upper ontology is a bundle of these fairly basic theories. To me, that's what an upper ontology is. So it's a number of things that could be modules. Do you want to take those pieces and reuse them in different places as well? Well, I dare say you can. So I think that a lot of these things are going to be very small when you look at them, which is a good thing. But then you get an awful lot of them, and that's not quite such a good thing. So what are useful bundles of these basic pieces, I think, is going to be a key question.
Quentin Rolfe from Walters Kluwer. I have two comments. The first comment was with regard to the role of expressiveness in terms of publishing. I'm actually part of the publishing world, and what we find is we actually need some expressiveness, and the reason why is the question is generally not known prior to the end user asking the question. And that's one aspect. The other aspect is we are really moving away from a system where publishers were providing just documents or books to really representing the information within the documents and being able to have that information in terms of data systems to answer questions. So that would be the first comment that I had. The second one that I have is with regard to you say that the authoritative sources should be developing the ontologies. If you look at something like FRBR, which is really developed by an authoritative source in terms of representing bibliographic information, and you look at its application that has been done around systems, there is not one real implementation, or it's always used in a slightly different way, which makes its reuse even more difficult. And I don't know if it's because of the lack of information that is available within the ontologies or whether there is something else. So just having the authoritative source and even with the explanation of how it should be used doesn't always mean that you are getting to the point of reuse that you want to achieve.
Okay, so on the first one of those, we were saying something slightly different about what we were really saying was about the level of semantics, which not actually about expressiveness. So, in fact, generally, less semantics means you have semantics is orthogonal to expressiveness. Expressiveness is really about the kind of complexity that you might want to be able to say, whereas semantics is about how much of it you want to say explicitly in terms of what the rules are in particular, and how much of it is just about the vocabularies that you're using.
I agree and I disagree in terms of if you're just representing the publishing world in terms of one document and just the document themselves, yes, you're probably right that the semantic is rather small, but if you are representing the knowledge within these documents...
No. Indeed, that's completely different. So you, what I would expect is that you would have a significant amount. I don't know where this came from. It was something that came out from the discussions. Not something that I can defend particularly. It's just what I'm just trying to say what it does say. But whether it's right or not is something else.
This is Tim Finan. My comment on this slide was, when I saw it, was I'll bet there was nobody from the publishing industry that was involved in this track.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, they may or may not have been.
I've talked to some people
out there. Person said that. I doubt if it was a publishing person that said that, that's for sure. Anyway.
Yes.
Brandon Neiman, Semantic Community. I'd like to get your comment on a new approach we've taken that seems to overcome a lot of the bottlenecks you described. And it's the following, and the specific example was the healthcare.gov site. So within 2 weeks, we were able to mine the healthcare.gov website for both what the knowledge model was and what the knowledge, the actual data was, and put those in spreadsheets. And that was handed off to a knowledge modeler using the BeInform tool, which develops a meta model in a graphical user interface under which is the ontology and the rules. And then it becomes a working application, and we produced a video of it. All of that in 2 weeks, overcoming. And it really is the approach that I expressed in Mike Bennett's group of building the ontology from the actual data. That's what a data modeler does. They develop the data model from the actual data. Well, this is just a higher expression of this. You actually mine the data, and then you use that in a data modeling tool that's at a higher level. than developing the individual elements of the ontology. But you end up, because of the $40 million investment in the tool by the Dutch government, you end up with the ontology underlying that knowledge model.
Yeah, well, that's a classic example of automation. And I'm certain that automation and semi-automation needs to be at the heart of any involvement of applied ontology and big data and the semantic web. I don't think that anything that doesn't involve some use of automation has a snowball in hell's chance.
Okay, maybe we should make that the last question and thank Matthew for the presentation and then transition to the next track. Well, thank you very much, Matthew.